Live from the In the Room studios located in the Net Carrier and Cloud, this is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Hey, good evening, everybody. It's the Witching Hour, Thursday night on the VOC Nation. It's worldwide, folks. I'm Dean Compton. I know you listen to me every Sunday night on Compton After Dark at 11:30 p.m. right here at VOCNation.com. But I also know you love her dork world, his dork world, gracing your Thursday night. Friday morning, technically, but you really can't say Friday morning about midnight. It doesn't make sense. Another thing that really doesn't make sense is how much the most lovely, or loveliest, I guess, if you're into using correct English, the loveliest lady in the world loves me. It's a mystery. But she's right here. It's her dork world, too. Emily Scott, tell me something good.
Well, I think I've finally recovered from Dragon Con. It took about a week and a half, but I think I finally feel normal again. I've stopped scanning crowds for interesting cosplay when I realize everyone's just wearing normal clothes.
Well, but you know what? Dragon Con's over, but I am still cosplaying as a Kansas City Royals fan.
That's true. You're still maintaining your persona as sports guy.
Well, I ain't the sports guy. You can't fit me into no neat little box. I ain't the sports guy, I ain't the dork guy, I ain't the politics guy. I'm Dean Compton, and I'm incomparable, and if you don't believe me, you can ask Roger McKenzie of the Charlton Arrow, and he also wrote Daredevil and Captain America. It sounds like I'm introducing him like he's going to be on the show, but he's not. In fact, I have bad news for everyone. Christy Marks will not be here this evening due to a comedy of errors and technical snafus. Mostly on our part, and we apologize. We will definitely get Christy Marks at some point. Now it's almost become like a goddamn vision quest for me, like, you know, like I'm fucking Ahab or something. I was like, I will kill this whale even if it costs me everything. Even if it blows up the galaxy, I'll kill this motherfucking whale. I am going to get Christy Marks on here, you know, somehow, some way. And no, don't be mean, you know.
Are you saying that to me?
Yeah, I'm saying that to you.
I had no intention of being mean to anybody.
Well, I'm saying don't be mean. We didn't get her. We're trying real hard. But we can talk a little bit about some other things. We got some cool stuff on the Her Dork World, His Dork World Facebook page. Talk about that for a second.
Now I'm trying to think. I don't know, YouTube, what have you seen that's been interesting that I've put on there?
Well, you know, there's a lot of great stuff on there, people. Facebook.com/HerDorkWorld, His Dork World. You can email us at hdwhcwradio@gmail.com. Emily does the Tumblr. I don't even really know what Tumblr is or how it works, except that it's full of porn. Porn and comics. I know
you
that.
Said that
I know
to
that
me at one point, and I was like, there's porn on Tumblr? Like, I had no
idea.
I know,
idea. You're so cute. You're so naive. You're so cute.
It's not like I know that the internet is full of pornography, but, I mean,
I
the worst
like,
I had ever seen was, you know, some erotic fan fiction or, you know, some fan art of, like, the brothers from Supernatural together, because apparently that's a thing in their fandom. That was
it's a thing in every fandom.
Shirtless drawings of Loki.
Yeah. A lot of that. There's a lot of Tumblr that ain't much different than DeviantArt.
Yeah, there's a lot of the same, a lot of crossover there. Some of the same artwork.
No, there's no crossover at all. In fact, the line of demarcation is very strong. But I do want to say, we apologize again. We're going to have to truncate the show because we don't have much of nothing to talk about. We got really ready for Christy Marks, and Damn, we got lost. We got lost in the flood. We weren't ready. We should have had more backup material ready. Emily, we're letting people down. I blame you because I'm a man and you're a woman, and that's what we do.
You're right. It's all me. I should have had backup show by myself.
I do want encourage everybody to go to the Facebook page and look at the Viewmaster reels from Dungeons and Dragons, the animated TV show.
Oh, yes. That was something I saw today, and it's amazing. I would love to have some of these just as, like, art prints. They say such funny things. Like, it's just, various illustrations of things you might expect to be happening in D&D, and then all of a sudden, it's just like a dwarf with a crystal, and it has some, like, ridiculous caption. I'm like, these are surreal and amazing.
I like fiendish battle because what does that mean? I mean, first off, it does appear that there's some kind of weird turtle, dragon, alligator, demon fighting these people. And I guess, he's some kind of demon or whatever, so he's a fiend. And that's what makes this a fiendish battle. But you could also describe fiendish as a particularly heinous battle or a very evil battle, right? Fiendish battle, you're not telling me anything, Dungeons and Dragons.
It's a flowery language, the
agreed.
Fantasy
language. It's an important part of it. We'll chat for just a little bit. You want to be a part of this tonight, 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234. Open lines for the next 5, maybe 6 minutes. If you have something you'd like to talk about, if you want to talk about how much cooler the Misfits are than Jim and the Holograms, which I was going to talk to Christy Marks about.
And I still cannot wait to hear some more about that, because everybody loves the Misfits. Everybody knows that.
I think that was very emblematic of all of the 1980s. Well, not all of them, obviously, but the more popular 1980s animated series. I think that there are a lot of cool G.I. Joes, don't get me wrong, but the Cobras are lots cooler. Destro, Baroness, Storm Shadow, Zartan and the Dreadnoughts, my favorite, Scrap Iron, so cool. And then look at, Transformers. I mean, Megatron's cool as hell. Soundwave isn't just the coolest Transformer ever. It's probably one of the 10 coolest things ever, period.
Wait, that's the guy with, the tapes, right?
Yeah, that's Soundwave. He's the bad guy.
He talks in a voice like this, and he says, eject, Laserbeak, eject, ravage.
It's amazing. And then his chest opens up, and a cassette changes into a robot bird called Laserbeak. And Laserbeak isn't just a clever name, people. He shoots lasers out of his beak.
I guess, I don't know. I was very peripheral to the Transformers. My siblings liked it a lot, but I never really saw it much myself. And I guess I would assume that Soundwave was so cool looking and the idea was so cool that he must have been a good guy. I was very surprised when he told me that he was, in fact, not one of the Transformers.
Well, he is. Well, they're all Transformers. He's a Decepticon. The good guys are the Autobots. The bad guys are the Decepticons. But this
so Decepticons
here and there.
Are also Transformers. They're all Transformers.
They're all Transformers. They're all Transformers.
Learn something today.
Well, the thing is there's a good guy. There's an Autobot Transformer that transforms into a boombox as well. His name is Blaster, and everybody hates him because he came out. Do you remember that Simpsons where they added that dog to the Itchy and Scratchy show?
Yeah.
Okay, that's this guy. Blaster would come out and be like, I love rock and roll. Kids are great. You should stay up late if you want. And you're like, oh, my God, who's this asshole?
Well, it's a spoof of the Great Gazoo from the Flintstones. The little green guy, but only Fred Flintstone could see. And the idea was that, we have this weird, kooky character show up, and that's going to improve ratings, and that's what The Simpsons was spoofing with that right there. Just, maybe we can all learn something tonight. Just drop a little slightly obscure, not obscure, outdated.
Well,
on y'all.
I have a great big surprise for everyone. We do have Christy Marks, despite the technical snafus, going to be able to talk to her for a little bit. Christy, thanks so much for finding a way to join us tonight, making your world a part of her dork world, his dork world. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing great. We're doing great, too. Sorry that there's been so much trouble. I swear, you know, when it comes to trying to get you on the show down south, we call it, you know, can't win for losing.
Yeah, it's a little tough since I work full-time during the day and then have to come home and usually work some more at night. So
we appreciate you, you know, finding a little time in your busy schedule for us. I did want to talk about what you're up, you know, what you're up to these days. We got a few questions for you on the email, and that was one of the number one was just like, what are you doing besides, I know you're writing a little for DC Comics.
Yeah, well, the main thing, the big thing I'm doing is that I'm a principal game designer for Zynga, which, of course, makes a lot of the big mobile games, previously
right.
Facebook games, mobile games, and I spent the last, year and a half doing all of the narrative and writing and so forth and story for Castleville Legends. And I'm just coming off of that and working on a new project. But that's sort of my full-time gig. And then when I get home at night and weekends, I'm also writing some comics for DC Comics. The first thing I did for them was a reboot of a 1980s comic called Amethyst.
Right.
And they wanted to bring that back and update it. So that was a dream project for me. I really loved working on that. And then when that ended, I worked on the Birds of Prey superhero group book. And in fact, I think the last issue is just coming out. I'm just starting to see advanced reviews on it. And I'm currently doing another, I can't really talk about the details, but I'm doing two issues that are part of a bigger overall special event thing that's going to be
right.
happening at DC.
Well, I promise you we won't ask you no questions about it so you don't feel like you've been put on the spot.
Yeah, it's not, since it has, I don't think it's been announced yet. There are no public details on it yet, so I can't,
unfortunately,
can't talk about that one, but it's one of these big special event kind of things that DC does.
We won't draw the ire of Didio and Morrison on you. No problem. No problem. We'll keep you safe. I do want to talk to you a little bit about Amethyst, though, because that, you know, Amethyst, like you said, started in the mid-80s, Princess of Gym World. Even then, a very different type of character for DC Comics than we were used to seeing. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, you know, being a fan back in the day, were you drawn to it because it was so different from the rest of the DC universe? I mean, I still hear about it all the time from people. They're like, wow, that was amazing and, you know, unique.
No, I basically back then I pretty much read just about every comic that was ever put out. And I certainly was attracted to comics that had female leads. That always attracted my interest. So it was just, it was really more a matter of, I was more of a completist back then. I'm not so much anymore. Now I'm a lot more selective. But, I remembered the series, and I liked the series because of the fact that it had a female lead and a slightly unusual take on that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I do have an email question. Well, not really a question, but comment for you who want, excuse me, Sparky Ryan, a good friend of the show, wanted me to tell you that he's a big Sword and Sorcery fan, and he thinks it's more than a shame that that book, you know, didn't survive. And also, for some reason, he blamed the fans. He's like, the fans are stupid for not buying that one. I was like, calm down, man. I don't know that we have to badmouth anybody.
Yeah, I have some theories about what happened, basically. But I think it was a book that could have been pitched to an audience a bit better than it was. You know, they put it under a title that was a fairly meaningless sort of title, even one of those generic kind of titles.
Right.
And then they tried to make it, and they made it an anthology, but they put things together that didn't really go together. I mean, the backup features never really matched up to the main feature. You know, so I think it was a matter of trying to go perhaps just a bit too broad with it instead of actually trying to pitch it to a specific audience.
I feel there's definitely a bigger audience than maybe there ever has before been before for sword and sorcery things. You know, so many fantasy properties have become, you know, so mainstream now. I feel like there's definitely, you know, even if you are trying to specifically go for a more fantasy audience, I feel like there's definitely a bigger fan base for that than there ever has been.
Yeah, and the thing, yeah, and I think that they could have reached a much larger female audience. You know, again, if you try to go too wide, I think, on these things and hit everybody, you can maybe miss out on your actual prime audience, and I think that's probably what happened there.
Yeah, I'd be inclined to agree, and you see that not just in comic books, but, you know, Emily and I, we do some shows every now and then about the Gordon Ramsay shows, and that's something that even in, like, a restaurant, if your menu is too big, you don't get anybody because you're not good at anything or known for anything. And you're right, I think the title really hurt it. I personally thought Amethyst had more of a brand than Sword and Sorcery, which, you know, you can't even trademark or copyright.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, and how many books have been had titles like that? I mean, the very first comic book story I ever sold was a Conan story, and it appeared in a title called Sword of Sorcery. You know,
right.
But it's like one of those titles that's just kind of been around.
Well, I always hear it used almost like to refer to like a genre of literature, comic books, art. Like sword and sorcery is like the kind of thing it is. And I don't know if maybe I had a misunderstanding of that phrase, but like I said, I feel like I just hear it used in a very general sort of sense now to refer to like, you know, almost any fantasy property.
I mean, I don't know how it's come to be interpreted, but I had always associated that particular term with a more Conan brand of fantasy, the Conan and Red Sonja type of fantasy.
Right,
and
Cole the Cole,
yeah. You know,
so oh,
I that's just me. I don't know how many other people agree with me on that, but that's what I would tend to attach that to as a genre versus just anything that's fantasy that happens to have swords in it. You know, I don't know. There are many different types of fantasy.
Would you classify your Sisterhood of Steel as a sword and sorcery, or just swords mostly?
No, I would not. I would absolutely
okay, I mean,
not. And the reason being is because although it has some mysticism in it, I actually stayed away from the outright sorcery kind of element that you do get in the Conan and Red Sonja books. I went a little bit more towards realism may not be the right word, but, you know, a little bit less of the far-out fantasy with sorcery and a little bit more like Caesar's Conquest of Gaul kind of direction. So there is mysticism. There is some sense of that going on there, but there's no outright sorcery in the way you might be used to thinking of, you know, wizards and demons and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. That's pretty much how I felt about it, too. Talking with Christy Marks here, live on the VOC Nation worldwide. Her Dork World, His Dork World. I'm Dean Compton alongside Emily Scott. You want to be a part of this tonight? 855-VOC-RADIO, 855-862-7234. And I know Sisterhood of Steel, you did that book at Epic Comics and Eclipse Comics, both of which were, Epic Comics being an imprint of Marvel for creator-owned properties, and Eclipse, you know, being a company that was almost, you know, basically centered around that. They're both very creator friendly from what I've heard, but what were some of the differences in working with one and working with the other? Because Epic Comics still part of Marvel, which even then would still have been part of a larger corporation, and Eclipse Comics was essentially three people.
Yeah, it was Cat Ironwood and Dean, it's been a long time, Mulaney, I think. And independent company. Well, the situation was that I would happily have stayed at Marvel. I would happily have stayed with Epic. But there was this incident that occurred. And if you think about it, the Epic books, at the time, they were a brand new thing. This whole idea of comics for adults that had mature content and mature language in it was really brand new. You know, it was the first time it was quite groundbreaking to, I mean, I'm not counting like underground comics, but I'm talking about mainstream
right.
comics. And what happened was that there was another book called Moonshadow, and there was, you know, a couple of other books, and we used, as I said, used adult language. Well, some distributors, at the time there were numerous distributors in comics, so some distributors from a certain part of the country made a fuss. They got upset. They didn't like some of the language. And so instead of just standing up to them and saying, that's the nature of these books, they're for adults, instead, the word came back from Marvel Day to censor things. And so I got the word from Archie Goodwin, who was my editor, that I had to censor some things in the fifth deal, and I wasn't given a choice. It had to be done. Well, I got very pissed off about that, and I wrote about it. I had a newsletter that I did at the time. It went out to all these fans. And I wrote about it to indicate that the censorship had happened, and Archie was so furious that he cut off the book. So he killed the sisterhood because he did not like me editorializing about censorship. He got very strongly anti-censorship. I feel very strongly against censorship. And that was why it did not end up staying at Epic. And so we looked around for a new partner, and at that time I was married to Peter Ledger, an Australian artist, and so we decided that he would then become the artist on the book. And we looked around and talked to people and ended up thinking that we really liked the people at Eclipse. It seemed like a good relationship. And so we just ended up working very directly with them, and they were very strong advocates for creators' rights and for independent kind of work. So it was a very nice partnership with them. It was before they ended up having that enormous flood in Gurneyville. They were in Gurneyville, and they ended up getting wiped out. All this, their stock and everything ended up getting wiped out by a flood. But fortunately, prior to that, I ended up with all of the remaining stock of the graphic novel. So I have
all of
that.
Wow, that's very fortunate. That's very, like, because there's a strong argument, and I hear this, you know, all the time to this day, that Eclipse would probably still be going today if it wasn't for that flood.
Very possibly. It really was devastating for them.
Emily, what do you got for Christy Marks? And I feel like I've been hogging the conversation. I've been rude, and that's bad for a Southern gentleman. I apologize.
And Peter and I did some other work that Eclipse published as well, so it wasn't just that one thing.
What else did you work on there?
We did a series. Well, it was not so much a series. It was a three-part story that went into their Eclipse Monthly book. It was called Carlos McClear, the Californio. And it was a really fun thing that I wish we could have turned it into a regular series. But it was set in Spanish California in 1841. And we drew very, very heavily upon early California history. We went to all the missions and did tons of research. And so the basic premise is that this man came over from Ireland, married a woman, had a son. Carlos McClear is that son. And what the son doesn't know is that he has inherited this both a power and a very terrible curse from his father, who brought it across with him from Ireland. He fled from Ireland thinking he could escape it, but he couldn't. And so this is the kind of Carlos McClear discovering this unknown heritage that he has and what the consequences are. And it's this fun blend of fantasy and Spanish California history, which we found very fascinating.
But it seems like you like to gravitate more toward the fantasy side of things. Did you also, I read, I think it was in your biography that you have on your website, you know, you've loved comic books for a long time. I think you had mentioned when you were younger, you used to buy so many that your parents said, you know, you can't buy anymore. You have to sneak them in the house.
Oh, I hear that.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I hear that.
Did you also ever get into superhero comics as well, or?
Well, I grew up on superhero comics. I grew up wanting to be Batman. Yeah, when I was a kid, I wanted to grow up to be Batman. I read books about criminal investigation, and the thing was that in the time period that I grew up in, women were not in the FBI. You know, there was no path for a woman to do any of these kind of things, and so I pretty much gave up on that idea. But I still have some of my very, very earliest Batman comics in which I took a ballpoint pen and I turned Robin into a girl. So that,
awesome.
So that there's, you know, long hair, little boobs, you know, all this kind of stuff, so that Batman had a little girl running around with him, not a little boy. So I kept, from the earliest age, just kept trying to inject myself into that universe.
At that time, I mean, I hear from a lot of female comic book fans now that it's, you know, even now they might take a lot of flack or feel sort of unwelcome in a comic book community. Did you experience that when you were younger? And as a girl comic book fan, did people consider it unusual at the time?
I was a lone creature. There was nobody around me that I could associate with that was reading or into comics. I was completely and utterly on my own. I had there was no sense of fandom. I didn't have any comprehension of that, and I had no connection to anybody else that was reading comics. I was kind of a strange, solitary, weird creature who was really into the stuff that at the time there was Frederick Wortham's book called Seduction of the Innocent. Right. And this guy Wortham came up with all this bogus, fake, so-called science that supposedly proved that juvenile delinquency was caused by reading comics. And so there was this very strong anti-comics feeling at the time that
they literally burned
parents' reaction to. Pardon?
They literally burned them. There were literally comic book burnings. They'd pay kids to come burn
their
comics.
I'm sure there were.
It's ridiculous. There's a great book about it called, like, The 10-Cent Plague. And there's, like, churches would, like, give kids, like, candy and prizes, that, you know, based on the pounds of comics they'd bring in. And that happened in America, folks. America.
Well, not much changes in that regard. I mean, we're still burning Harry Potter now.
Yeah, well, you know, what can I say? There have been book burnings throughout the ages, and that's just wherever the forces of ignorance raise their ugly heads, and you're going to see that sort of thing happen.
I just remember being a kid and going to the library, and I spent a lot of time in the library as a kid, and the first time I saw a table that they had set up for Banned Book Week.
Oh,
and
my.
There were all these books on, you know, librarians are, you know, sort of notorious for being very anti-censorship, and and there was a table set up sort of in celebration of some of these books that had been banned in the past. And I remember seeing all of these books on the table that I had read and being like, why on earth would I just didn't understand at that age why on earth anybody would possibly want to prevent me from reading these things. And it was just such a weird notion. Thankfully, nobody ever tried to burn a book in my presence, or I probably would have reacted very badly.
Yeah, I lived in the library when I was a kid, just a voracious reader. And we had a bookmobile. And so I would read everything in the school library, and then I'd go to the bookmobile and just absolutely eat my way through books.
I went to the bookmobile,
like you were
too.
Saying,
I had a great time. I got a book. I checked this book out like 20 times called You Will Go to the Moon, and it promised me that I would have a colony on the moon with a super moon rover. I'm still waiting, everyone. That has not happened. I feel like
yeah, I know. Where's our jetpack?
I know. Where's our jetpack?
You picked the right thing there.
I discovered science fiction, of course, just by grazing through the library, and that was when I really got into reading a whole lot of science fiction, and I actually discovered fantasy a little bit later, after I had discovered science fiction.
I had a very similar experience. Like when you were saying, you know, you were a lone creature reading these comic books, I had a very similar experience, you know, just being on my own a lot as a kid, but I was reading like Douglas Adams, and that was my introduction to science fiction. I discovered that far far before any fantasy, and I also had no sense of, like, a greater fandom. There just wasn't, you know, there was no way to connect with people at that time, and I feel like now, like, if you're a kid and you get into something now, you have an immediate...
Now you've got all the connections in the world, literally. I mean, yeah, it's just amazing.
You can go to cons, you can get on message boards, you can do all these things, and but at the same time, there was also no pressure to sort of fit into a particular fandom or you know, now, like I said, I feel like there's almost a lot of, you know, pressure, like, we don't want this particular kind of person in this fandom or whatever. And, you know, because when I was growing up, there was just none of that. It was just me on my own enjoying these things. And then later on, when I got older, meeting other people who really loved them.
Yeah.
And forming
same,
community
yeah.
that way, just sort of a more organic. And as great as it is now that, you know, fans have instant access to each other.
I
at the same time,
wonderful.
Yeah.
And by the way, I adore Douglas Adams. Absolutely adored him. I discovered him through the radio program first. You know, that my Australian husband introduced me to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the radio program, since it was a BBC program, and absolutely fell in love with it. Just fell in love with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they've done some really good. I think they're going to do another one here not too long. They're going to do another adaptation of it for the radio. There's been some really great ones. We just recently did a show about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because Dean had never read it. And
never
I
had.
Felt like he could not miss out on that particular experience.
It's great. It's great. I should have read it a long time ago. I was a fool, but I was a fool in regard to many things before I met Emily. So, you know. And that's just how it goes. But I was actually, it's really weird to hear you guys like, you know, you're like, I was a loner. I lived in the library. I want to say that, like I felt alone, but I always had these friends around. It was really weird. We were all into like comic books and like science fiction and stuff. And it kind of insulated you, but then you all also felt like you felt alone together, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, it does actually make sense, yes. But it,
yeah.
And I think it might be the difference, realistically, between being a girl and a boy. You know, it's just different.
Yeah, well, that's
yeah,
the point of this show. That's why it's Her Dork World, His Dork World. We do a lot of things. We do cultural exchanges. That's how Douglas Adams happened. You know, I read that, and I think Emily had to watch wrestling or something that I liked. You know, in exchange, and we would comment about it, you know, and just get back and forth, because that's one of the things that I try and tell people a lot, and they don't, you know, they don't want to listen, but I'm like, gender dynamics are very different across the board for men and women, but when we get into, like, microcosms of society, e.g., you know, various dork cultures, then they split again, and the splits are fascinating to me. And, I mean, there's certainly, unfortunately, rampant sexism, and we criticize that a lot and everything as well. But it's always interesting to me to see that, like most of the lady so-called dorks I know, they gravitate towards, like, science fiction. But the guy dorks I know, we want wrestling and superheroes. And it's just neat to cross those worlds over.
Where do you think fantasy falls in that realm?
I don't know. That split's really weird. That's one that, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, we're speaking generally, so, you know, people do what
yes.
they do. But fantasy is one of those things that I think goes both ways. But, like, if I sit down and watch Lord of the Rings and I watch it with a lady, they, you know, like when I watched it, the lady I watched it with liked it for different reasons than I did.
Interesting, because I read Tolkien early on, and it had a major impact on me. And I, in fact, I've ended up working on two different Lord of the Rings video games. Interestingly enough, largely because I know so much about the property, having read it over and over and over again.
Which games did you work on?
Let's see. I'd have to look it up. The second one was called War in the North, and I can't remember what the first one was called now.
As far as who, when it comes to fantasy, I feel like men and women don't necessarily like different fantasy, but there's definitely a difference in who they try and sell what to. And I noticed this a lot. Like, I had a friend who... he loved to go to, like, Borders or Barnes & Noble, like, about three times a week, and he always would go and just pore over, like, the science fiction and fantasy section. So I spent a lot of time just looking at, just cover after cover. And it seems like if it's a female author, there is some romance on the cover. They very specifically try to highlight the fact that whether or not that's why women are gravitating toward these books, that, you know, there's always some, like, you know, like a kiss on the cover. So it looks like very much like a romance cover that just happens to be a dragon in the background or something. Whereas, you know, if you take the same book and if it was by a male author, they'd put, you know, a dude in armor and a sword and, you know, something completely different on it.
There's a folk song out there called, you know, something about don't put the bimbo on the cover of my book or something like that. Yes, it's something that that authors do tend to comment on between one another. It's the same with, you know, it's actually the same though with comics, is that they're usually doing these covers out so far ahead of the script before I turn the script in that I'll get covers like, where did they come up with that cover? Where did that come from? You know, but part of it is because they don't have the script yet, so they're kind of guessing. And that doesn't always work out so well.
It's something that bothers me even with non-genre fiction. I'll just be looking through, like, just the general fiction section, and I'll notice, like, every book that's written by a woman has, like, either a purse or some shoes or a glass of wine or a cat. Like, one of those things is going to be on the cover. It doesn't matter what the book is about. It doesn't matter what the book is about. It could be about, like, some woman who had to escape a concentration camp, and somehow they've managed to put a purse on this cover. Somehow, some way, they found a way to shoehorn something to let you know, in case you hadn't noticed, that a woman wrote this book.
I've actually seen there was a website that actually did a comparison of that, showing, demonstrating with numerous covers the ways that covers were geared differently, you know, for the male author than for the female author.
I think I might have seen the same article. It was like they took two books with very similar plots, and it's like,
yeah,
here's the guy cover, and it's this, you know, sort of general fantasy. Here's the female cover. Here's like a lady standing by a horse next to a sunset, like wistfully staring at someone.
I got a caller on the line, Christy, if you'd care to take a caller.
Okay.
All right, caller, you're on the air. What's your name?
My name's Jay.
Hey, Jay.
How are y'all doing tonight?
Questions for, I, you know what? If I was doing any better, I'd have to be twins just to handle it. You know what I'm saying?
I do understand.
What you got
I
for
do
tonight,
understand.
Jay?
I was calling because I am a huge longtime fan of the cartoon Jem and the Holograms. And I just had a couple questions about the creation of that, if you could answer them. I know you probably get asked a lot of questions about, like, where you came up with the concept and things like that, but I've watched the show as a kid. I was fortunate to have parents that were like, okay, you can play with dolls. So I had one of the dolls with the light up earrings. I think it was a Misfit. But what inspired you to create this awesome?
Okay, well, you have to understand that I was hired to develop the animation series. But Hasbro had the line of dolls. They had already developed the line of dolls. So this was in the same vein as, you know, Hasbro did G.I. Joe, so they hired people to create an animation series around all of the G.I. Joe stuff and so forth. And so this is the same kind of a deal. So they were still in the early stages. They had early prototypes. They hadn't even really settled on what the product names were. So one of the really frustrating challenges at first was, like, the characters kept changing names. You know, so, you know, and so, you know, Roxy was Rue, and no, Stormer was Rue, and Aja was Jade, and Shawnee didn't even exist at first, and they just kept kind of changing. And she wasn't even called Jem at first. The very first name for that character was just M, as in music.
What?
So it was just the letter M, and then they realized that they were going to have a great deal of copyright and trademark problems. And so the character was originally called M and Misty and Morgan, and she went through various name changes, and then finally ended up being Jem and Jerrica. So my earliest scripts still refer to the character as Misty and Morgan and M and, you know, all these other names. So that was very interesting. But basically, they had the dolls. They did finally settle on what the product names were for the dolls. You know, this was Pizzazz. This was Jerrica.
Yeah.
This was Kimber.
Pizzazz rules.
And they knew that it was going to be Jerrica, and they knew that Kimber was going to be her sister, and that Rio was the boyfriend, and that, you know, the Misfits were the bad girls, and they had the holographic computer named Synergy, and the earrings. So they had those elements worked out for the toy line, and then everything else was up to me. So I got to come up with everything else. All other characters, all of their full names, their biographies, their backgrounds, who they were, what they did, all of the Starlight Music, Starlight Foundation, Eric Raymond, all of that stuff. So I got to come up with all of that in order to create the 65 half-hour animation series. It was a syndicated animation run, and that's why you ended up doing these 65 half-hours, which is just unheard of today. But which was, you know, just amazing back then. And so that was
Absolutely.
What I got hired to do, all of that animation series development.
You got another question, Jay?
Yeah, with her, the Synergy was already a part of the toy line. Had they already talked about, like, the earrings and all of that, or was that a development that you had a part of, or was that a collaborative effort?
Yeah, no, they knew they wanted the earrings. I think that was already probably built into the toy.
That's so crazy to me that, you know, like, I have a creative background, and it's just to create the product before the story is so, so different to me. What inspired you to create the Starlight, like, what with the Starlight Foundation and with Starlight House, is there anything from your life or were there causes that you were passionate about that were reflected there, or?
You know, I'm trying to remember where I pulled that from. I think it was a matter of, well, we want to do lots and lots and lots of shows, so there needs to be lots and lots of character interactions and things to draw from and things to work from, and also just the sense of, to me, it just didn't seem like it was enough to just create a show about a music executive and a rock star, because, yeah, you know, it's fairly, I don't want to say shallow necessarily, but, you know, there's obviously stuff to work with there, but I wanted there to be an extra dimension to who she was that demonstrated that everything that she did was for a cause, was for a good purpose, that, you know, that they were caring people. And
very altruistic.
I think that's probably mainly what I had in mind. And I went a bit overboard. I created... It was my first time actually developing a series, so, you know, it was my first job in that of being able to do all of that creative work. And so I think I went a little bit overboard with the Starlight Girls, because I created, like, I think 12 of them, and I probably could easily have settled with 5. So I thought, okay, you know, I think I got a little bit carried away there, but nonetheless, they served a particular purpose, and it really then set apart the good girls from the bad girls, because the bad girls were just out for themselves. They're selfish. They didn't care about anybody else. Although I had fun with Stormer, giving Stormer a softer side, which I think worked out really well, too.
I do too. I do too. The fashion that is in the art is amazing, and there's not at you know, at this point in time, if you walk into like any hipster bar in any major metro city, you're going to see Jim and the Holograms sitting there talking. If you're going into a cool bar, you know you are. Because
it has had an amazing influence, and I cannot tell you how often I run into someone who's a Jim fan. I mean, it happens just constantly. It happens all the time. And right at Zynga, where I work, I can't tell you how many times someone has said, "Oh my God, you created Jim!" You know. So it comes up a lot.
For girls and boys, you know, who grew up around the time that I did, it's still something, you know, I hear mentioned all the time. It just becomes something so sort of ingrained in pop culture that, you know, you hear casual references to it, you know, all the time now. You can't say the word outrageous without someone going, "It's truly outrageous." Like, it's just permeated so many things.
By the way, that phrase came from Hasbro. I didn't actually come up with that one myself. That was one that was like a marketing phrase that they wanted to throw in there.
Jay, I'm going to let you have one more question, then I'm going to have to move on.
The dolls were all well, and the characters were all diverse. How was it creating diversity in the characters when you were already presented with the dolls? Like, this is what the characters go. You know, this is like, how, basically, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how do you steer clear of blatant stereotypes?
Well, you know, I had to actually beg Hasbro to show me what the dolls looked like. So first, I was creating blind. I had no idea what they looked like. And as someone who's working in a visual medium, I take a great deal of inspiration from having the visuals in front of me. So I had to actually just beg, and they finally sent me some Polaroid shots of these prototype dolls so that I had at least something I can put into my head to work from. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the interesting things is that Shanna wasn't even in the original lineup, and then she got added in. But in animation, it has always been extremely common to be very careful to include ethnic diversity, and I feel very strongly about it myself. But
absolutely.
Mainly what I looked at was what makes for an interesting mix of character. You know, what can you give to this character that is going to create a really interesting set of cross flows with this character and that character and this other character and this character over here? And it's just a part. It's like creating a whole matrix of personality types that will interact in ways that will give you interesting stories. So it's more about doing that. Like, how can you create a character that's character A going to get along with character B or not get along? Are they going to be competitive? Are they going to be best friends? And that gives you the fodder that you need for your stories.
Hey, Jay, we appreciate the call. Appreciate you listening.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Christy.
Yeah, take care.
Great work. Thank you.
You
be well.
Me too.
You know, speaking of Jim and the Holograms, I wanted to, you know, I was a big fan growing up, which, you know, it's amazing how many boys, like, we really hated girls, you know, I mean, because we were 8 and it was the 80s and we were not fans. But, like, all the boys, we all watched Jim, we all watched G.I. Joe, we all watched Transformers, we loved them all. And one of the underlying themes, I think, to us was that on each one of those shows, the heroes were cool, the heroines were cool. But, man, we love the bad guys a lot more. We love, you know, like Soundwave. We love Storm Shadow. And to this day, I love the Misfits. The Misfits are, like, some of my favorite characters of all time. Why do you think that's the way that turned out across the board when it came to those, you know, toy tie-in cartoons? I don't mean to belittle them because they stand very well on their own, even to this day. But, you know, across the board, even with He-Man, the bad guys are a lot cooler than the good guys. Not even stronger, but cooler.
I think really because you can just get away with more when you're doing the bad guys. They can be a little bit crazier and do a bit wilder stuff, and you could just kind of have more fun with them. Because your good guys have to be fundamentally good guys. So that right away puts certain constraints around your characters. Whereas with the bad guys, you don't have the same constraints. And so I think it just ends up being that you just have a bit more fun with them.
Misfits were probably my first introduction to that, you know, at a young age, to that idea that, like, you know, you learn all these really good lessons from the good guys, and, you know, there's certainly a reason why those characters have maintained such popularity, and, you know, everybody still loves Jem, but everybody loves the Misfits, like you were saying, and, you know, so even at the same time you're getting these good moral lessons, you're also, you know, the idea of, like, you know, sometimes it could be fun to be a little rebellious. And I think that definitely is part of what helped, you know, has helped it, you know, become so iconic and stay that way.
Yeah, I think so.
Emily, what else you got for
Christy
tonight? Oh, go on, Christy. Well, they let you know right away their songs are better.
That's right.
I think that's one of the things that I really like about those characters too. Is, you know, I mean, I'm of the mindset, like, I took a quiz, which Action Hero and I was on, and apparently I'm Maverick, because according to my answers, it's not just good enough to be good at something. You got to let everybody know how good you are at it. I try to not be so prideful, but I think that was something that was fun about those characters as well, is the mystery, like, I'm awesome. And like you said, the natural constraints on the heroines would be like, you know, they have to be somewhat humble. They have to be nice and everything. On the other hand, Pizzazz can just, like, dump water on your head and just, like, walk away cackling. It's beautiful.
Exactly. Beautiful. Exactly. Yeah.
So
Emily,
what
else you got for
really
Christy?
What I'm really hearing is that I have Christy to thank and Pizzazz to thank every time you boast about how great you are at something. That's what I'm taking
That's
away
from.
That's
probably true. It's probably
I was
true.
Curious about. I was curious about. You know, I've heard. You know, I've read things from people who've done other musical shows about how challenging it can be to, you know, have new songs every week or every episode. Were you involved in the songwriting process as well?
No. What I would do, and what the other writers would do, is that we basically would write a paragraph where we want the song embedded. So we'd come to that part of the script, and then we'd say, and here, put a song about. And I would sometimes suggest things that would end up in the lyrics, but I basically would say, it's a song about, and I talk a little bit about what the song should be covering, the topic, the theme, and I'd suggest maybe some visual ideas, and then that would just get turned over to the people in New York, who they had a composer, and then they had lyricists. And then we had storyboard artists who would specifically do a sort of musical video storyboards. So my input would be to suggest the topic, here's what it's about, maybe here's some of the language for it, here's some of the visual ideas for it.
Were you ever surprised when you saw the final result?
Yeah, I mean, you never knew what to entirely expect, but usually I was pretty happy with the result.
We had talked earlier something about censorship, or just, you know, was there ever a time when Hasbro or anybody else in the production team was like, we can't do this idea, or this is maybe a little too risky for a show for the stage group?
There was one. I mean, for the most part, they were actually pretty good about doing stuff, but there was one particular story I could never quite get past them, unfortunately, and I wanted to do a story that dealt with a kid who had an alcoholic father. You know, I wanted to touch upon what it's like for kids who have to cope with an alcoholic parent. And, you know, if I had been willing to maybe be less true to the story and lighten it up somewhat, it might have gotten through, but I just wasn't willing to do that. You know, I wanted tell a story that had some meat to it, and it was just a little bit too heavy for Hasbro. But aside from that one, they were actually pretty good about letting us do what we wanted to do.
Right on.
Well, I know we said we'd get you off of here pretty quick because we didn't get this hooked up technically the way we wanted, and we kept you a little longer than I intended, and than we intended. And I appreciate you, Steve. We appreciate you sticking around here tonight. Emily, we probably got maybe one more question, and then let's go ahead and let Christy get back to all that work you've got to do.
God, hit me with a question.
Dean, do you have any more questions?
I'm pretty good for right now, I think. I think we covered just about everything. If I start opening another can, it'll be winding up one of those, like, giant cafeteria cans and take a long time to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. When I go to conventions, I find that I'll be approached by people from different nooks of fandom. So there'll be a lot of gem fans that will come up, and that's probably the biggest niche that I find out there, is that lots of gem fans will come up. But then someone will come up who's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fan, and then someone will come up who's the Captain Power fan, or the G.I. Joe fan, or, the Sisterhood of Steel fan, or one of my computer game fans. So it's because I've worked in so many different areas, it's weird. I seem to have, like, these little nooks of different fandoms out there for different things, and it's kind of fun.
And then you got the weirdo like me, who, like, across the board, like, I like Jim, I like G.I. Joe, I like Captain Power, I like Sisterhood of Steel, I like your ElfQuest work, I like your Amethyst work. I'm like apparently the amalgam of all your fans into one.
There you go. You're the metamorpho.
Do you ever have any Babylon 5 fans?
Yeah, those two. They're not quite as frequently, but I do get that.
Both of them.
I just find them to be a very, like, I'm a big Farscape fan, and that has a very, like, it's not a very big following, but it's a very fervent following. And
I
feel like
Farscape.
Loved
it.
Oh, it's amazing. It's probably my favorite sci-fi show, maybe my favorite show, period.
Emily just got to interview Gigi Edgley and Lainey Tupu at Dragon Con.
Oh, cool.
We'll be playing it, I think, next week, probably.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, that was a wonderful show.
And they just had their 15th anniversary. They did a few panels at Dragon Con about it. It was really great to, talk with them about the show, meet some other fans. And like I said, they're just such a fervent fan base. But I feel like Babylon 5 is something that has even a slightly smaller and maybe even slightly more fervent fan base. Like, as much as Farscape fans love talking about Farscape, Babylon 5 fans, since there's so few of them, when they come across somebody else, I just feel like there's this ravenous, like I have people ask me, like, do you love Babylon 5? And I'm just like, I just never really got into it. And there's, like, this disappointment. And so when I saw that you had worked on it, I was like, I wonder if there's, like, some desperate Babylon 5 fan who's, like, come up to you at con has been like, finally, somebody I can ask these questions to.
Well, interestingly, Babylon 5 is responsible for me being married to my current husband, because I ended up working on a Babylon 5 video game project with Randy Littlejohn, and he and I were doing all of this, the story and narrative development for this game, and we spent a couple of years working together on it, and then stayed together after the game died. And that was a game that had a fervent, fervent following of people who just were desperate to have that game come out, and it would have been really a phenomenal game, but unfortunately the company went down the tubes, and the game studio went down the tubes, and so the game never happened.
I guarantee you somewhere out there are some Babylon 5 fans talking right now about how much they would like to be playing that game.
Yeah, both of them.
It would have been very cool. And in fact, we shot some live action scenes for the game, and it was the last usage of those actors and those costumes and those sets.
Oh, wow. So it has a lot of meaning to you, personally,
yeah.
And as far as just the production itself goes.
Yeah, exactly. But unfortunately, that's what the games business is like.
Well, unfortunately, also, we are out of time. It is the end of Her Dork World, His Dork World for this week. But Christy Marks, we'd love to have you again sometime. I bet we could fill four shows talking to you. You are a delight.
Thanks very much. Y'all take care
next
of yourself.
Week, Hey, thank you. And anytime you have a project you want to plug, you feel free to come by. We appreciate you. Thanks so much for your time.
Bye-bye.
Next week, we'll have the Farscape interview, more Dragon Con coverage. And what else did you get at Dragon Con?
We also, we're going to do, I think, all the Farscape stuff together, in addition to my interview with Gigi Edgley and Lainey Chupu. You and I also attended a puppetry specific panel that they did with one of the guys who had done some puppetry work on the Peacekeeper Wars. So we will have that. You get to hear Lainey Chupu attempt to do his pilot voice and fail because he drank too much the previous evening. And also the 15th anniversary panel that they did, where you get to hear for yourself just how much they love Farscape and how much they love talking about it. And it just does a fan's heart good to hear. And I'm really excited for all the rest of you to get to hear it as well.
It's all next week right here on the VOC Nation Worldwide, Her Dork World, His Dork World. Thanks for tuning in. Be here next week, folks.
Live from the In the Room studios located in the Net Carrier and Cloud, this is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Hey, everyone. It is your favorite knockout, Mickey James, and you're listening to the VOC Nation.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Thanks for coming on down. It's Save Wrestling the Podcast and the Business Making Town. I am your award-winning hostess with the mostest, Shelly Funtime Martinez, and she is my co-host, Dazzling Danielle.
Woo! Hello out there.
And together we are the Martinez Girls. You finally did it. And you can join us here Monday, new time, 6 p.m. Eastern on the VOC Nation as we save wrestling together, Danielle. Fighting Woo! Crime. Woo!
Hey, guys. Brady Hicks here, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributing writer and the host of In the Room, thebradyhicks.com, and for the first time ever, vocnation.com. So happy to be part of the family. Join us each and every Tuesday night, 9, 8 Central, vocnation.com, thebradyhicks.com, myself, DJ, Derek McDonald, Ray Bogus, Anthony Sarlo, Kathy Fitz, breaking down all that's going on in wrestling today. And so much more.
Hey, it's me, the mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. Netcarrier has many great products and services to increase your bottom line. Be sure to ask your Netcarrier representative about our hosted PBX. Call Netcarrier today for a free analysis of your phone bills. 877-255-7733. That's right, 877-255-7733. Call now.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed. The entire building has just collapsed as if a demolition team set off. When you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not...
We are live with Carmine Confidential.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind.
Listen to Carmine Confidential. Weekdays at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. VOC Nation Radio Network.
The most polarizing personalities worldwide. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Looking for a DJ? Looking for someone to host your events? Then look no further. Philadelphia's hottest DJ and host, The Voice of Choice. The Voice of Choice has hosted the hottest events in the tri-state area. Book The Voice of Choice for all your karaoke, conventions, and parties. Go to www.vocnation.com for more information or email the Voice of Truth at voc@vocnation.com.
Are you getting lost in the cloud? Is technology moving too fast for you? Find your way at netcarrier.com. Ride the end cloud and soar above your competition.
This is Buggy Nova, your Candyland princess, and I want everyone to know that I love VLCNation.com.
Hey, how's it going? This is Amy Dumas, but you may know me as Lita. You're listening to the VOC Nation.